On this week's 51%, we speak with physician and author Dr. Alice Rothschild about her new memoir, Inspired and Outraged, tracking her transformation from a 1950s good girl to a fierce physician and feminist.
I really feel like it's important to remind women that we are powerful and we are normal, and that there's a lot that we can do if we trust our bodies.
Rothschild also takes a look at how women's health care has and hasn't changed since the 1970s. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our guest today is an award-winning doctor, writer, filmmaker, and activist. You may already be familiar with her work, even if you don't know it. Dr. Alice Rothschild is retired after a nearly 40-year career as an OBGYN. She taught at Harvard Medical School, where she is still a corresponding member of faculty, and co-founded the first all-women's OBGYN practice in Boston in the late 1970s. Through it all, Rothschild has cultivated a rich history as a feminist and peace activist. She contributed to the first edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves in 1970 and has written multiple books, blog posts, and children's stories on subjects like miscarriage and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She is a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and artist Robert Shetterly painted her portrait as part of his Americans Who Tell the Truth project. But Rothschild's latest book gets more personal. Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician, tells her story of growing up in the 1950s and 60s and transforming from a classic people-pleasing good girl to a fierce physician and activist in her own right. In it, Rothschild uses free verse poetry to explore her family's immigrant history, the struggles of growing up Jewish in a WASP community, and how women's health care has changed since her early days studying at the Boston University School of Medicine.
I'm old enough to have lived a whole lot of different lives and different segments of my life. And I really wanted to write a memoir that focused on what it was like to be growing up in the 50s and 60s. What were the choices for my grandmother, for my mother, for me? How did we take them? And then how did I turn out the way I turned out? So, you know, I was a very good girl in the 50s and part of the 60s. And I also had aspirations. And as I had aspirations, I ran into a huge amount of sexism and just all the barriers that existed then and still exist in other forms today. And I also thought that the current generations of young women and, you know, people in their 30s and 40s probably don't know much of this history, and that if we don't understand our history and the struggles we went through, and we in some ways let our guard down, we will lose the progress we've made. And I think we obviously have proof of that today with the whole abortion struggle. So I really wanted to write this. And I played with various ways to talk about it. And then the memories started coming to me in verse. And I've written poetry my whole life. You know, I've had a few poems published here and there, but never a book of poetry. And the more I thought about the memories, the more verse came. And so, you know, I'd be hiking or biking or asleep or something. And, you know, a line would come to me and I'd have to write it down. And then I would play with it and play with it and, you know, look at old letters and research it and refine it and create something that I thought was a powerful statement. So that's how it came. And it also is, for me, tremendously fun to write poetry. Because you can be very serious, you can be outrageous, you can be playful, and you can keep flipping around in all those different modes. And I think it's good for the reader as well as for the writer.
Yeah, it was fun for me to read, too. You know, I don't personally get to read a whole lot of poetry in my free time, so it was nice to engage with some of these heavier topics in just a different way. On that note about reminding younger generations about this history, you know, as someone who grew up in the 90s and 2000s, what was it like growing up in the 1950s and 60s?
Well, I could read a poem about that if you want.
Sure.
The Wreck of the Hesperus and Other Things, 1959, Sharon Junior High School, Sharon, Massachusetts. 7-1-A, later called the gifted class, saved my life and wrecked countless others. 1-A, to be distinguished from 1-B, 1-C, all smarties. 7-2-A, 2-B, 2-C, average but not definitely college bound. 7-3A, 3B, 3C, aka the dumb kids, see needs unmet. The aging Mrs. Langley chortled, "We were all too smart to study grammar," hence my lifelong struggle with the pluperfect, not to mention a certain haziness about the use and abuse of the semicolon. We were assigned to find a poem and memorize it. I wanted something long, hard, and spectacular. I chose The Wreck of the Hesperus by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Every night, I repeated 8 new lines until all 88 rattled easily in my head and off my tongue. The teacher was so smitten with my performance, she made everyone learn. It was the schooner Hesperus that sailed the wintry sea, behold the semicolon, and the skipper had taken his little daughter to bear him company. Made the entire class recite the whole damn poem at assembly. When the dreaded line, "The salt sea was frozen on her breast," came looming, the class went silent. No one willing to say the embarrassing, sexually suggestive word, breast. But my eager voice rang unmistakable, unencumbered, breast, reverberated over my muted classmates, washed across the entire 7th and 8th grade, squirming in the dark auditorium. Perhaps I should have kept my mouth shut. Being a smart, driven, outspoken girl left its own kind of wreckage on the barren shores of my hard-to-endure teenage loneliness.
Oh, wow. That makes me think of just some of my own dreaded classroom readings. And just that, you know, the fear and shame around the female body that gets thrown at us at an early age. You know, you write a lot about your family and childhood in the first half of the book. What was that household like growing up? And how did you decide that you wanted to be an OBGYN? Is that something that would have been accepted back then?
So when I was 6 years old, I announced to my parents I was going to be a psychiatrist. I have absolutely no idea why. I think I liked the sound of the word and everybody got all excited that this little six-year-old using this big word. But I was sort of a laser focused kid. So, you know, I was going to do that. And so when I was in high school, I worked at Mass Mental Hospital doing in the hair department, you know, doing hair, you know, cleaning and shaping women's hair. And when I went to college, I majored in psychology. I mean, I wrote a paper on schizophrenia in 9th grade. This was what I was going to do. And then I hit medical school. And medical school, where I was, which was Boston University, had a very Freudian department in psychiatry, to the point where there was a psychiatrist who got up in front of our class, which didn't have a whole lot of women because I was there before the wave of women, and told, you know, pointed to each woman in the class and said, "You are here because of your unresolved penis envy." I mean, it was that level of like, OMG. So I got very disheartened by the psychiatry that I was exposed to. I mean, I have a whole poem about the psychiatry textbook, which when you read it now is just appalling, but then was like the norm. And so I had sort of a midlife crisis in medical school. And the thing that happened that was very interesting to me as I watched my peers is that people were like, they'd meet a fabulous cardiologist and they'd say, "Oh, I'm going to be a cardiologist." Or they'd get, you know, fall in love with children and they were like, "Oh, I'm going to be a pediatrician." But I went into OBGYN not because I had ever met anyone I wanted to be like. I met so many people I didn't want to be like and so many people that I thought were really destructive to women and women's healthcare. So I went into the field to basically blow it up and to make changes in how women were treated. So it was a very different kind of decision-making process in terms of career choice. And very different from all my classmates. So it wasn't coming from my family. I mean, my family was, they were of the mode, you know, "You can be anything you want, dear, as long as, you know, you get married and have children and they're Jewish," and, you know, the whole list of things they had to be. But then after that, you can be anything you want. So that was a real issue for me trying to figure out how to run my life and experience my life and have my life and what kind of partner would I want and all that stuff.
You talk a lot about the pressure to be, you know, a good girl and make everyone happy. And that's something that I really connected with, too. I feel like that pressure is very much still around. But, you know, what did being a good girl look like for you growing up?
I think that the pressure, you know, post-World War II to be, you know, grow up and be a good mother and, you know, be nice and to be well-behaved and to be a virgin when you got married and all those kinds of pressures were very strong. And I think it's probably different now with different social mores as well as social media. And It's a different political scene. I mean, the 50s and 60s, there was this feeling of, you know, America's going to be okay and we're all going to make it. And if you work hard, you can join the middle class. And, you know, it was a very white fantasy, but it was the fantasy. And I think it's really much more complicated now. I mean, you could speak to that more than me.
Yeah, some of that still seems pretty relevant. you mentioned you wanted to be an OBGYN to, I guess, just blow up the field. What were you seeing specifically that you wanted to change?
How can we count the ways? So first of all, there were no women. And the head of OB in the school I was in literally looked like a pig. I mean, he had a little turned up nose and a round face. And we used to like think about how unusual that was. And he was so sexist. He gave a lecture on the first day of the course called What is a Woman? And it was a woman is a man's mistress, a man's mother, a man's competitor. I mean, literally a list of things like that. And it was so bad that the women in the class and a few, you know, sympathetic men actually had a protest, you know, like, this is not okay. And it was sort of like, oh, really? Can't you take a joke kind of response? And, you know, I saw a lot of obstetrics being practiced on poor women of color without much supervision because, you know, they weren't really human, you know, and you could learn how to sew up an episiotomy without much supervision because, you know, it's a woman of color. It's a black woman. She's poor. She's not going to sue you, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of attitudes towards women and, you know, teenagers that, you know, we're all kind of hysterical and, you know, premenstrual syndrome and postpartum depression and menopause, you know, these are really not worth studying and certainly not worth learning about. And a little Valium will help all of this. So it was a kind of very, patriarchal, condescending attitude towards women that drove me nuts. And I thought, we can't go forward this way. This has to change. And so that's the kind of things I saw.
That's kind of cool, thinking about, you know, healthcare and your career in this feminist lens where it's activism in its own right.
Right. Because, you know, practicing medicine is essentially a political act. You know, you either buy certain framings or you reject certain framings. You either are hyper aware of the impact of race and class and attitude and, you know, all those kinds of things, or you just kind of sail along in your own little boat, oblivious to all the influences that are making people well or making people sick. Once I got it, once I saw the politics behind everything, it really motivated me to practice in that kind of way. So when I opened my practice, every woman got a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves. You know, it was just, we tried to do things very differently. And that was really exhilarating to be able to do.
What was that process like of creating your own practice at that point in time?
So, you know, when people graduated from the residency, a lot of them were offered jobs. The men were offered jobs in other people's practices. And in my year, we started out with two women and we ended up with three women. And we were the first three after two women who had gotten in 2 years earlier. So there'd been a total of five women that had come to this program, you know, in the history of the world. And so it became very clear that no one was going to offer us a job and also that we wouldn't want to work in their practices. So it was a very mutual dislike of each other. And what I was told later on is that the older attendings were all betting on how soon we would fail because, you know, how could a bunch of women figure out how to have a practice and be successful? So, we chose to have an all-woman OBGYN practice with midwives and nurse practitioners. We also had a pediatrician who was married to one of the OBs, and then nurse practitioners that worked with them. And we chose to open in the inner city. It's now totally yuppified, but where we were was an inner city placement. And we also chose to work part-time in health centers because we wanted to reach women of color and women of lower economic status and, you know, non-English speaking women and all that kind of stuff, as well as a feminist health center. So we started out very, very differently than most practices. Now, at the same time, what we knew about running a small business was exactly zero. And we definitely suffered from that because we had to figure it out as we went along. And insurance companies weren't as crazy as they are now, but they were pretty crazy. Since we were the only private practice that took Medicaid, which is, you know, the insurance for people in low socioeconomic areas and people with disabilities and that kind of thing. I mean, Medicaid paid $4 for a prenatal visit. And, you know, a huge number of those women were high risk because they were from poor economic situation, you know, poor nutrition, all those kind of things. So this was like really tough to figure out. And the hourly wage at the health centers that we worked in was $24 an hour. That didn't pay for our receptionist in our office. So we really struggled economically. And we lasted 9 years. And we always had this joke that we would quit when our salaries were less than our malpractice, which took 9 years. And even though we had a malpractice that was much less than the usual cost, because we were Harvard doctors, Harvard insured doctors, the business side of it was not our strengths. But what we did when we were in existence was really incredible, I think. And we gave courses long before, you know, groups were giving courses on prenatal care and menopause and that kind of stuff. The other thing that was happening was that we all had delayed our babies. So we were all, someone was always pregnant, breastfeeding, pumping, you know, it was a real, that kind of practice, which makes it hard because people go out on maternity leave. And we had a 3-month maternity leave. And the attendings that were, quote, my friends and trained me for 4 years did not step up and say, oh, let me help you, dear. They were like, no, your patients are too complicated. They're crazy feminists. They're poor women. We don't want to have anything to do with you. So there were challenges, but we were very successful in what we were doing. But I think ultimately the lack of night call, you know, we were on mostly every other night. Sometimes we'd have a third partner. We'd be on every third night until someone got pregnant. This was really hard. So after 9 years, we went to a larger HMO where we worked with a lot of people that were very sympathetic to us. But that was a whole different struggle at that point.
We're speaking with Dr. Alice Rothschild, author of Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. You mentioned earlier that you became an OBGYN because you wanted to make a difference in women's healthcare. Reading your story has kind of reminded me about another book that I read this year called All in Her Head, and it kind of just walks through all the different ways the medical system has failed women when it comes to the various systems of the body. You know, there's been this idea throughout medical history that women are either, you know, complete mysteries that can't be understood, or that they're just smaller men with different sex organs. So, you know, how have you seen things change over the years when it comes to women's healthcare?
When I was in medical school, all lab values were male lab values and the women's values were deviant, which I found fascinating. The field has changed enormously. I mean, when I started obstetrics, when I took obstetrics rotations in medical school, I actually saw some twilight sleep, which was very popular in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, where women were heavily medicated with a sleep med, a narcotic, and an amnesic, which wasn't totally amnesic. So that, you know, I saw women screaming and smearing feces and strapped to their beds with leather scraps and, you know, a mid-forceps delivery because they couldn't push and, you know, just awful, awful things. So I got to see the transition from that to what was called the natural childbirth movement, a radical thought that women actually know how to have babies if you give them enough education and support and don't treat them like a medical specimen having a disease. So I got to be part of that whole struggle. And then I got to see how epidurals came in. And epidurals are a form of regional block so that the lower half of your body is numb. And at the beginning, epidurals were very dense. Women really couldn't feel anything. And so they had tremendous difficulty pushing and pushing the baby out, which is one of the last things you have to do. And then I got to see epidurals getting better and better. And I got to see women who were used to be like, this is my body. I have the power to have this baby. I just need appropriate supports and education and I can do it, which most women can, to, oh, I can't possibly do it. I need an epidural. So I've seen all different kinds of waves of approaches to obstetrics. And I've also seen the growth of the home birth movement. So lots of different things going on. I think that we're much better than the bad old days, but we're not there yet. And, you know, obviously, if you have a high risk pregnancy, if you have medical problems, if you really feel like you need pain medicine, then you should have it. I'm not one to make judgments on this. But the messages to women in general are, you know, you're not strong enough, your body wasn't built to do this, you know, you're defective in some way, which is what advertising tells us every day of the week. That permeates how women feel about themselves. And so I really feel like it's important to remind women that we are powerful and we are normal and we are healthy, unless otherwise noted, and that there's a lot that we can do if we trust our bodies. And medicine doesn't have a messaging system that suggests that women should trust their bodies. Medicine is about, you know, controlling our bodies or improving our bodies in the defective ways we were built, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm curious because you not only experienced advances in medicine, but in women's rights. You know, you mentioned earlier that practicing medicine is a form of activism. Would you consider that to be your main method of activism over the years, or did you get to see how the broader feminist movement changed too?
Sure, because, you know, I didn't wake up a baby feminist. I had to, like, figure things out. I was politically involved in, you know, all sorts of women's reproductive issues, giving talks and taking care of women around menopause, you know, childbirth practices. I had to develop an understanding of how the system worked and how I wanted to fit into it. So it's not like I had this immense consciousness that I, you know, went down and worked in the world with my immense consciousness. You know, when I was trying to get into medical school, my goal was to live through physics and organic chemistry. And when I was in medical school, my goal was to survive the first 2 years of academic, you know, pouring vast amounts of literature into our brains. And then when I did my residency, my goal was to know the skills of an OBGYN. And so when you're working 60 or 80 hours a week and you're terrified half the time and you're in a fairly oppressive environment much of the time, having a feminist consciousness is not the first thing on the list. The first thing on the list is, how do I get through this day? And what can I learn? And how can I protect myself from all the slings and arrows? And who my friends and allies are? So it was, you know, a gradual development. And I try to share that in the poetry, because some of the poetry is like flying forward and some of it is just getting knocked down. But that's how real life is. And, you know, I'm just human. So I can be depressed and I can be happy and I can have a panic disorder, and I can do all the things that humans do. And my goal was to figure out how to put this all together in a political and personal context, and share my growth, because everyone is in some kind of growth pattern. And I think it's useful to hear other people's journeys.
I think so too. You know, there's a line in one of your poems that stuck with me. It's called On the Cusp. It's 1966. And you say, quote, "I live by the rules, still figuring it out, voted against wearing pants to class, convinced that was disrespectful to the professors. Thankfully, that opinion didn't last very long." I just really liked that. I think sometimes people don't want to look back on some of the sillier opinions they may have held over the years. And especially if you consider yourself a feminist, you know, there's this pressure to be a good feminist. But, you know, I think we all start somewhere and we all have those things where we look back and think, oh, it's probably good that I outgrew that.
Yes.
Well, is there another poem that you'd like to share with us?
Sure. This one's called Consciousness Raising. 1970 to 1973, various kitchens, living rooms, bedrooms in the Boston area. College grads, just sorting things out in a world made for men after the wild competitive scramble to get into medical school. We were a flock of mismatched birds, flapping as fast as we could, soaring too close to the sun, dive bombed by birds of prey, disoriented without a compass or patterns in the stars or the pull of the magnetic field. We swooped, fluttered, nested, gabbed over hot tea and mulled cider, spiked with too much red wine, confessed our bewilderment, whispered our outrage, plotted our revenge. The search for sisters led us to women marching in the streets, writing self-help books, our bodies ourselves, plastic speculums, flashlights, shedding light on the mysteries deep inside. We searched for new vocabulary, a radical politic to guide our way. Feminism, autonomy, health, a human right, patriarchy and privilege, the avarice of capitalism, the meaning of consent, the objectification and commodification of our bodies. The magnetic field tugged, stars shimmered. We noted the terrain and topography, established our migratory flyways. A medical student or adult woman patient is not a girl ever. Do not trust anyone who says, "Don't worry your pretty little head about that." Or, "Women are so emotional. Here's a Valium for your PMS, headache, depression, anger." Pick your fights, find your allies. Honor your cervix. You know your body better than any doctor. Listen to it. Use those wings. The index of our obstetrics textbook had a subversive entry, male chauvinism. A secretary added that phrase and listed all the pages in the book. Your uterus is the size of a fist, for good reason.
For good reason. I like that. What has it been like for you going back and revisiting these different parts of your life?
Well, you know, the whole thing was just a remarkable journey. It was sort of like being in, you know, psychoanalysis, but doing it by myself. And so, you know, some of it was very painful. I mean, I wrote a poem about having my third miscarriage, which was one of the low points of my life. I also wrote a poem about my consciousness raising groups and how I grew from that, or my graduation and what that was like, or, you know, some of it was just fun, sort of in a retribution kind of way, that I finally got to say exactly what I'd been thinking, but I kept my mouth shut, because, you know, you have to be strategic when you open your mouth and when you put your head down and get the skill set you need to do a stat C-section or a hysterectomy or whatever I was in training for. So you can't fight every minute of the day, but it all gets stored up. And so it was really powerful for me to be able to talk about the experiences.
Well, Dr. Rothschild, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we go, I wanted to ask you what you hope readers most take away from your story. Because obviously, in the last few years, we've seen the fall of Roe v. Wade. We've gone backwards when it comes to abortion rights. You know, what advice do you have, or what do you want people to know from your work as a doctor and activist?
Well, I think that the first thing I want people to do is just read the book and enjoy it. The second thing is that I think it's important to remember our history and where we came from and the struggles we had, and not to be complacent. And particularly given the Supreme Court and our new fearless leader coming up in January with all of his henchmen, I think for women, we are entering an incredibly dangerous time and our reproductive rights are totally under threat. So this is a time not to be complacent and not to put your head in the sand and get a massage and hope that it'll all go away in 4 years. We need to get the massage, but we need to be out in the streets. We need to be protesting. We need to be writing our congresspeople. We need to be, you know, organizing ourselves as sisters and allies and, you know, people who are non-binary and all the different subgroups of society that we have now visually today. And I think it's important to be very politically aware and active and not to be quiet. This is a time not to be quiet.
Dr. Alice Rothschild is a physician, author, feminist, and filmmaker. She practiced as an OBGYN for nearly 40 years and taught obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School. Her latest book is a free verse memoir about coming to age in the 1960s and forging her own path in medicine. It's called Inspired and Outraged: The Making of a Feminist Physician, and you can find it at most major booksellers. Dr. Rothschild, thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.